Chapter 64. The heavy gray wool slowly began to fade away, and Pitt became aware that he was lying in an upside-down position on something hard and in something wet. He hung there long minutes, his mind in the twilight zone between consciousness and unconsciousness, until gradually he was able to pry open his eyes, or at least one eye. The other was caked shut by coagulated blood. Like a man who had just struggled up from a deep, dark tunnel into the daylight, he squinted his good eye from right to left, up and down. He was still in the helicopter, his feet and legs curled upward along the floor, and his back and shoulders lay against the aft bulkhead. That accounted for the hardness. The wetness was an understatement. Several inches of water sloshed back and forth around his body. He wondered vaguely how he had come to be contorted in this awkward position. His head felt as if little men were running around inside it, jabbing pitchforks into his brain. He splashed some water over his face, ignoring the sting of the salt, until the blood diluted and ran off, allowing the eyelid to open. Now that he had regained his peripheral vision, he turned his body so that he was sitting on the bulkhead and looking up at the floor. It was like staring at the crazy room of an amusement park funhouse. There was to be no exiting through the cargo door. It had been jammed shut from the beating the fuselage had taken during its journey across the Titanic's deck. Left with no other choice but to get out through the control cabin hatch, Pitt began climbing up the floor, using the cargo tie-down rings for hand grips. One ring at a time, he pulled himself toward the forward bulkhead, or what now constituted the ceiling. His head ached, and he had to stop every few feet waiting for the cobwebs to clear. At last he could reach up and touch the door latch. The door wouldn't budge. He pulled out the Colt and pounded at the latch. The force of the blow knocked the pistol out of his wet hand, and it clattered all the way to the rear bulkhead. The door remained stubbornly closed. Pitt's breath was coming now in heaving gasps. He was on the verge of blacking out from exhaustion. He turned and looked down. The aft bulkhead seemed a long way away. He gripped a cargo tie-down ring with both hands, swung in a series of ever-widening arcs, and then lashed out with both feet, using all the muscle a man can use when he knows it is his last try. The latch gave, and the door sprung upward at an angle of 30 degrees before gravity took over and brought it slamming back down. But the brief opening was all Pitt needed to thrust a hand over the doorframe, using his fingers as a jam. He gasped in agony as the door fell across his knuckles. He hung there, soaking up the pain, gathering the strength for the final hurdle. He took a deep breath and heaved his body through the opening as one would climb through a trap door in an attic without benefit of a ladder. Then he rested again, waiting for the dizziness to pass and his heart to slow down to a near-normal beat. He wrapped his bleeding fingers in a sodden handkerchief and took stock of the control cabin. No problem escaping here. The cabin hatch had been torn off its hinges and the windshield glass knocked from its frames. Now that his escape was assured, he began to wonder how long he had been unconscious. 10 minutes? An hour? Half the night? He had no way of knowing, as his watch was gone, probably wrenched from his wrist. What had happened? He tried to analyze the possibilities. Had the helicopter been blown into the sea? Not likely. It would have been Pitt's coffin in the abyss by now. But where had the water in the cargo section come from? Maybe the aircraft had been ripped loose from its moorings and swept against one of the boat deck bulkheads of the derelict. That didn't work either. It couldn't explain why the helicopter was standing in a perfect perpendicular position. What he did know for certain was that every additional second spent sitting around in the middle of a hurricane and playing question and answer games moved him 1 second closer to more serious injury or even death. The answers were waiting outside. So he worked himself over the pilot seat and stared through the shattered cockpit windows into the darkness beyond. He was staring straight up at the side of the Titanic. The gargantuan rusty plates of the hull stretched off into the dim light to the right and left. A quick downward look revealed the angry sea. The waves were swirling about in massive confusion, often coming together in huge collisions that sounded like an artillery barrage. Visibility was better now. No heavy rain was falling, and the wind had slackened to no more than 10 or 15 knots. At first, Pitt thought that he must have slept through the hurricane, but then he figured out why the sea was leaping skyward without any sense of direction. The Titanic was drifting in the eye of the coil, and only a few more minutes would pass before the full fury of the storm's rear quadrant would fall upon the wallowing ship. Pitt edged carefully through one of the broken windows, over the nose of the helicopter, and then dropped onto the deck of the Titanic. No sensuous or erotic interlude with the world's most beautiful woman could have come close to matching the thrill he felt at finding his feet on one of the old liner's waterlogged decks again. But which deck? Pitt leaned over the railing, twisted around, and looked up. There on the deck above was the bent and broken handrail still clutching a part of the helicopter. That meant he was standing on the B-deck promenade. He looked down and saw the reason behind the aircraft's ignominious posture. Its journey toward the boiling sea had been abruptly halted by the landing skids, which had caught and then wedged into the observation openings along the promenade deck, leaving the helicopter hanging in an upright stance, like some monstrous bug on a wall. The great swells had then slammed against its fuselage, jamming it even tighter against the ship. Pitt had no time to appreciate the miracle of his salvation, for as he stood there, he felt the increasing pressure from the wind as the tail of the hurricane approached. He had trouble getting his footing, and he realized that the Titanic's list had returned and she was leaning heavily to starboard again. It was then that he noticed the running lights of another ship close by, no more than 200 yards off the starboard beam. There was no way of telling what size she was. The sea and the sky began melting together as the driving rain returned, lashing his face with the cutting power of sandpaper. Could it be one of the tugs? He wondered. Or perhaps the Juno had returned. But suddenly Pitt knew. The lights were from none of these. A shaft of lightning flashed, and he saw the unmistakable dome that could only be the Mikhail Kurkov's radar antenna shield. By the time he had climbed a stairway and staggered to the helicopter pad on the boat deck, he was still wet to the skin and panting from the exertion. He paused to kneel and pick up one of the mooring lines, studying the parted ends of the nylon fibers. Then he rose and leaned into the howling wind and vanished into the curtain of water that enshrouded the ship.